From one islander to another, Isle of Wight Radio proudly presents John Hannam Meets.
It's welcome back to Mark King for John Hannam Meets. On the way to your house, I was thinking back to the very first time you and I met. It was 1980.
Yes,
when
it was.
Sort of down at Ryde Airport, as we would call it.
Le Babaloo Club.
Yes.
For the dear listeners who can't see what I'm pointing at home, we're sitting in my dining room and I've got a bit of memorabilia around. And this is a poster for Le Babaloo Club. It says, Discotheque Club. It's rock and roll night on Tuesdays. Minimum age 18 years. Come to the Babaloo, the island's liveliest nightclub. Luxurious and informal. Live groups, go-go girls. How about that, yeah? Resident DJs. Ryde Airport, fully licensed till 2 a.m. Telephone Ryde 3309. My goodness me.
At that time, they'd just begun to build Tesco.
Had they really? Was they starting
just
that already?
Digging out the foundations.
Right.
And there was a go-kart track still there at the time, of course.
Yes, and of course, the go-kart track have their little section in there now, because there's a go-kart track back there again, white karting, which is very good fun if anybody wants to go. And they have their little tea bar in there. It's called Le Babaloo, which I think is a great homage to an old club.
You're on the eve of another British tour, which runs from October the 2nd till about the 25th.
Of October, yeah. Then we're straight overnight into Holland. And so we crack on. We've got 12 shows out there, all of which are pretty much sold out now. So it's business is good, thank you, John, you know.
And the last British gig, Royal Albert Hall.
Yeah, I love that place. It's one of my favourite venues. Well, it probably is my favourite venue, I think, you know, because it's one of the few circular venues you can play where the sound isn't half bad. They've really sort of got it together with the acoustics. And sound equipment nowadays, when they have these line array systems that you see dangling from the ceiling, are so good and focused, you can really sort of hit the spots around. But the Albert Hall, I've been lucky enough to play there so many times with not just Level 42, but as part of the Prince's Trust Rock Garden.
I'm going to mention that later.
Yeah. It's, you know, and to tread those stages. The reason it's so special to me, John, is because the first album I got was Live Cream. And there's this lovely enigmatic shot on the front cover of Cream playing. It probably was their last show at the Royal Albert Hall in London. And it was just great because there's a sort of a shot over Jack Bruce's shoulder looking across to Eric Clapton. And when I did eventually get the chance to play with Eric at the Albert Hall, it was one of those moments where the hair on the back of my neck was stood up because, you know, memories were great.
Going back to 1980, that's 38 years ago, I think, like that.
Yeah.
You never really expected Level 42, surely, to be still playing after all those years, or did you?
Well, who at the age of 22 thinks that they're going to be, you know, just heading out on another tour? I'll turn 60 on this tour, too. So
do you?
I do, yeah. Yeah, I know you thought I was 39, which meant that I was one when you interviewed me.
Yes.
But
means I'm very old.
well, I think you're looking a lot better than I am, John. Well, whatever
do you?
You're wearing. Yeah, so whatever monkey glands you're taking or something, it's working a treat, my friends, yeah.
For an ex-drummer, you've done awfully well, really, haven't you?
Well, on bass guitar, I have.
Yeah.
There's always a bit of a squabble about, you know, which one is the lowest on the rung of the band's ladder, and it's either the drummer or the bass player. So I'm sure in my band now, Pete Raybigin is quite a phenomenon, so I'm obviously on the bottom rung in the band. But it did work out well. John, you know, I did start as a drummer, wanted to play drums, absolutely loved it. And I really just applied that sort of rhythmic approach, you know, because it's all hands, to playing the bass guitar when I eventually did to take it up. I never thought I'd end up playing bass guitar. It was just something to do because the music shop I got a job in London didn't sell drums. So I kind of told a little white lie and said, oh, you know, I'm a really good bass player. And without checking me out, you know, these are the days before CVs, obviously. But without checking out if I could play or not, they said, well, you sell the basses, you're our bass expert, and make the tea and sweep up, you know, which suited me absolutely fine. Yeah.
You weren't a very good scholar at Cass High, were you?
Well, why'd you say that, John? That's very hurtful.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I wasn't. You're absolutely right. You know, as my late father said, we're not intellectual, we're just nice people, which I thought sums it up all right. And I absolutely adored school. I had the best time. My high school years and my junior school years were absolutely brilliant. But it was just a social thing. You know, I had loads of mates. And I suppose I had some kind of kudos in the fact that I was playing in a band, and that's what, you know, most kids wanted to be in bands, and rock and roll, you know, pop was massive in the 1970s. So to be playing out in clubs at the night, of course, what this meant was I couldn't be doing my homework, and hence the rot set in, you see.
Your careers master wasn't too impressed when...
No, not at all. We got called in, and Mum, bless her, she sat there, you know, with a handbag on her lap while he's saying, "Oh, Mrs. King, you know, you've got to get this bug in his head out about being a musician." And I can remember railing, saying, you know, why? I suppose I would have been 14. I couldn't understand. I said, why do the best musicians have to come from New York or Los Angeles or London or something? I said, you know, everybody has to start somewhere. And I remember him rolling his eyes and looking at my mum. But my mum was great because she just said, well, you know, that's what he wants to do. And I think that's exactly it. It's got to come from the kid, hasn't it?
Oh, yes. Looking back on those days, holiday camp bands, good grounding for you, really?
Fantastic. You know, that playing bands is the best way to, you know, I'm not a huge fan of being a bedroom musician. You know, you can have fun there, but on the instrument, I mean. But if you really want to get your chops together and learn how to respond to other musicians, you have to play with other musicians. So I was kind of spoilt for choice on the island because, as you said, there were holiday camps all over the place. We had lots of bars and pubs. We just talked about the Babaloo Club. There was the Blue Lagoon. There was the Oasis in Ryde. It went on and on and on. And sadly, so few places now on the Isle of Wight for that sort of thing. You know, there's the odd live music venue. Strings in Newport is wonderful now. No, for me, it was great because I got a chance to play with a lot of London sort of session guys, I suppose they would have been called, who came down to bring their family on a free holiday, as you would like, you know, going through the summer. You know, and as a young man, it's great because you'd sit there listening to their stories and them telling you how, oh, I walked down Shaftesbury Avenue and there's Phil Seaman sat in the window giving it some on drums, and he's a real drummer, you know, you'll never be as good as him, son. And all this sort of stuff is really good, you know, it's good grounding. And you know, musicians at the beginning are nothing if not competitive. There always seems to be a thing of, you see somebody do something on telly and you think, yeah, I could do that, you know, I could probably be better than that. And of course, growing up on an island makes it even more so, because your first hurdle is to become the best on the island, which I never did, by the way. Phil always carried that mantle, but don't tell him.
When you left the milk round, you were earning about 32 quid a week. And I love that story of how you sort of threw everything in the van and drove off to London, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I bought the very milk van that had been retired from the round, this old Bedford CA, lovely. So the sort of thing you see as dormobiles, they get converted into. But this one was just a regular old farm van. Had a column shift, which had broken, so I had a mole grip that I was changing the gears with. It wouldn't have passed an MOT, I have to tell you that. Funny thing was, is that the fuel filler cap, it being a farm vehicle, that had obviously been lost over the years somewhere. And so the farmer just put the inner tube of a milking machine. So there was this big rubber contraption, which was a funny pink colour, that was about 2 feet long. And I can remember pulling up on the A3 on my way to London. And then those days, of course, people used to come and serve you petrol in the stations. And the look on the, because I was watching him in the wing mirror, the look on the guy's face as he was sort of unravelling my fuel can, which was coming out, that's the strangest thing.
Hi, this is Dennis LeCourier, the voice of Dr. Hook, and you're listening to John Hannah Meets on Isle of Wight Radio, because you have such good taste.
So who had the idea for Level 42 then? Was it you or...?
No, I don't think there was one idea. It wasn't, you know, like, let's form a jazz funk band, let's see what happens. It was just a case of, you know, that I'd met Boone and Phil playing in bands on the Isle of Wight with John Wheeler and Chris Mew and the likes. So when we all eventually met up in London, you know, birds of a feather stick together. And we, you know, it's very hard when you go to a big city from an island. It's very hard sort of breaking in and making new friends. So it was, you know, my great fortune that both those lads came up to London as well. This would have been 1979, I guess. And then we had the great fortune of meeting Mike Lindup, who was, you know, became the keyboard player. And just as four guys who liked the same kinds of music, we used to go together and rehearse at Monday evenings at Mike's music college, the Guildhall School of Music in London. And we got a rehearsal room there. So we went up, and Phil you know, was the only guy that had a set of drums, so he played the drums. And that was all right, because that meant I could sort of flip from bass or guitar or whatever. But I was just doing this until my band came along, you know, and I'd get back on drums. And I think all of us felt the same way. And it was only when, sort of after about 3 or 4 months of rehearsing like this, we got a crack. Andy Soiker, who was a friend of John Gould, Phil and Boone's older brother, who worked in the record label MCA, he bought Andy along to hear us play one day. And he was very unimpressed, I have to say. He was sort of kept shaking his head and pushing his specs up with his finger. And at the end of it, he said, well, there's that one tune you played I quite like. And he said, you pointed to me. He said, you were playing bass guitar, I think. And you pointed to Boone. You were on guitar. It was the chord sequence to Love Meeting Love. So we played that again. And he said, yeah, he said, look, if you can get a singer and you can come up with some lyrics, I'll record that. I think that might do all right. And that's how we started. And of course, we didn't like the idea of getting somebody else. We didn't know anybody else. So I sort of, you know, oh, summer nights. I started croaking through with a melody, and Boone wrote the lyrics. And that was really how we sort of got going.
I was going to say, you weren't a natural front man, but you soon picked it up, didn't you?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's needs must, isn't it? You know, this thing of, you know, when you're all mates and stood there going, he wants us to get a singer in. And we're all going, oh, I don't like the sound of that. And then it's like, well, who's going to sing then? And everyone looks at their feet, you know. It's like, well, I can't sing. I'm playing drums. And I did sort of get lumbered with it. It worked out all right in the end.
That fantastic bass style of yours, how did that come about, really? Because over the years, you've sort of influenced millions of bass players throughout the world. So how did you hit on that idea?
It really was sort of just transferring the drumming technique, you know, with left and right hands playing equal parts over onto a bass guitar, because that was how I sort of heard music. I wasn't too up to speed on notes or harmony or anything like that. But something, you know, advice I would always give to beginners is, you know, if you're a right-handed player, don't get hung up on the fingers on the notes. Really what makes the music swing is your right hand, whether you're playing rhythm guitar, lead guitar or whatever. So get that going, get the right hand going, and you'll sound much better to yourself when you sit in the room playing. You know, tap your foot, keep time, and just get good rhythms going, because that's what makes people dance. The notes come along, because after a while you think, oh, that works. But you can do it in your own time, you know. It's funny, though, John, that you very kindly said, you know, I might have been influential for, you know, some kids over the years. But I remember the dread of working in Macari's music shop in Charing Cross Road. Saturdays would just be all these kids had come walking in, no intention of buying anything, but they'd pick up a guitar and they'd play Smoke on Water or Stairway to Heaven, the riff to that. And it was just constant. The next one would come in and he'd play it. You know, these were the sort of the classic guitar songs of the time. And it was ironic that sort of 10 years on, I happened to go into Macari's and saw the guys there. And they just, instead of going, Mark, hey, they went, you're responsible for all the kids coming in on a Saturday now and this din of slapping out the riff to Love Games.
For a while, two sort of bass legends lived on the Isle of Wight. You still live here. And the late Jet Harris, of course.
Yes, of course.
When you go back to the Shadows and Cliff, he was sort of a very charismatic bass player. And you were both living here for a while. It's quite remarkable.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And that's that. I never met Jet. You know, he was a lovely guy. The nearest I got to any sort of cross-pollination there was that when I was playing in a holiday camp with Rod Gammon's trio, we were playing at Little Canada Holiday Camp, and we used to do a Shadows song. I think it was Apache, which kind of gave you the opportunity to have a drum solo in it. And as I was playing, it was the usual sort of Thursday night at Little Canada. There were about four people in the bar. And the staff, and this member of staff came walking to the front of the stage, and he just stood there with his arms crossed. You know, the body language was, I'm not having any of this. And he watched my solo. And when I finished, he started booing. And like I said, I would have been about 15 at the time. And so I said, what's up? And he said, that's rubbish, that is. And I said, well, how do you know? He said, because I'm, what was the drummer's name?
Tony Meehan.
He said, I'm Tony Meehan.
No.
And it didn't occur to me as a 15-year-old twerp that, well, if you're Tony Meehan, why are you working as a barman, you know, in a holiday camp on the Isle of Wight? But I just sort of took that on board. And I went, oh, wow, you know, amazing, fantastic to meet you. And he went, yeah, well, anyway, you know, pick your game up because that's rubbish. And went about his business. Anyway, the following week, we went back to do the gig. And I said, is Tony Meehan in, to whoever was working there now? And they said, who's that? I said, well, he was working here last week. And they went, no, he wasn't. No, he'd just been released from Camp Hill. He was just doing a week's work up. So I got completely conned and suckered in. But there you go.
I also got conned by a guy who said he was Tony Meehan on the Isle of Wight. And I sussed him all out. And he wanted paying for the interview, but it wasn't Tony Meehan.
No, it wouldn't have been the same chat,
I
would it?
I wonder if it might.
Isn't that incredible, John?
Yeah.
So he's still going, is he? Is he still playing?
I don't know.
I want to hear him solo. I'm going to stand there and boo him. That's rubbish.
Yes. So jazz funk, in a way, was sort of, wasn't mainstream music, but you got your sort of mark, didn't you?
Well, we were lucky because it gave us a vehicle to get into the business on. You know, you need an audience because you need somebody coming to see the gigs that you're playing and you need somebody to buy the records. You know, it doesn't have to be huge amounts, but as long as there's an interest there, record companies will get behind you and give you the support you need. I think where we got smart, if you like, is that we sort of took on board that as soon as you have a hit record, you think, oh, that's good, that, you know, let's it'd be good if we could come up with another one. And so you actually start working to have hit records, not because you're selling out, it's because you reach a much wider audience. Mm. And then you can start playing, you know, instead of playing the 06 Club in Southend or, you know, Gold Diggers in Chippenham or something like that, which holds about 180 people, you can start going up to halls that are doing 400, 600, 1,000, 1,200, then 2,000 seat halls. And it's, you know, there's this great sort of exponential thing that happens. And it's only on the back of the fact that, one, you got on Top of the Pops, two, that Radio 1, you'd be on the chart count down on a Sunday. And so it was very important. And by the time we got through to 1985, John, we kind of learnt the lesson quite well.
World Machine sort of changed a lot for you, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. It changed everything because it gave us our first top 10 hit in America. And once they start sort of taking you seriously, that applies a lot of pressure to the other record labels around the world. So everybody kind of has to pick their shoes up because they're the guys that are really paying the bill for everybody. And, we got Something About You was top 10 in the States. And then that obviously got us onto, we got to open touring for Madonna for 3 months around the States. Tina Turner, you know, and on. We just seemed to just keep working and working, yeah.
That was an amazing step for you, wasn't it?
It's huge, yeah. It was massive because, once again, the step up from, you know, playing the small venues, which I still love. I love, you know, I love playing anywhere. That's the thing. But it doesn't matter now. I can say that because we've also played, you know, with Madonna at Soldiers Field, 102,000 people, I think she had in for that show, which is just incredible. And I'd never seen a crowd like it until, Rhea, my wife and I, we went to Glastonbury, I think 3 or 4 years ago, and saw Dolly Parton. And they had 200,000 people in on the Sunday afternoon. It's such a sea of people. It's incredible.
She was amazing, wasn't she, Dolly Parton?
Yeah. Did you see it? Did you?
Yeah.
I thought she was incredible. And I'm happy to say we share the same agent. And I hope he's listening to this and can get me a few more gigs of that size. Please, Mr. Agent.
Did you get to meet Madonna? Because sometimes the big stars don't sort of talk to the supports, do
no,
they?
No, she was very sweet. She sort of summoned us on the first show, which was very sweet. So we all sort of filed in like naughty school children. And she was very smart. And I think that all of us were really struck by the fact that actually this isn't just a girl with an image. This is somebody who's running the whole show. And she did, because she didn't have a manager as such. She just had legal advisors, and she had these three lawyers that took care of the contracts. But everything was what she wanted to do. And that was sort of became sort of quite an inspiration, really, because you take that on board. So anyway, she came to see us, you know, she ushered us in, summoned us in on the first show and said, lovely to have us on. And then we had a party sort of halfway through the tour on a day off in somewhere in Texas, I think. And she sort of crashed the party. And it was great. It was sort of just sort of dancing the night away with her and her crew. And then the last night, you know, the last show, which was in New York, we had another big sort of shindig. And she was great, you know. And I mean, there she is. She's just a complete legend, isn't she?
And Tina Turner, of course.
Oh, Tina Turner. Well, she really is a sweetheart. And she does like to sort of pop her head in your dressing room and come in. And once again, we had another really nice day off. It was Thanksgiving Day, I think 1987, Thanksgiving party. We were on tour with her and she threw a big party, and she just had this thing. She had a microphone in the sort of the party room, which was for all her crew, all our crew, you know, all the musicians involved. And it's where I met John Myers, actually. I've become good mates with. John was MDing for her in the band. And I've since done the sort of Night of the Proms shows around Europe with him. And he's a wonderful... He's had that song, Music. You know?
Oh, yeah. John Myers, fantastic.
Yeah, incredible. Yeah. And
It sort of makes you tingle, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does, you know. Not quite so much when you hear it every night, sort of 3 months on the road in Europe. But sort of more of a numb pain.
John Hannam, he's on the air now. Hannam, doesn't matter. He's a lovely boy.
We talked about the hits. Also, you had lots of hit albums, didn't you? Because it's nice to be an albums band as well as a singles band. Isn't
well,
it
is. You know that there's it's funny just in terms of. I hate to sound like it's all about product and shifting units. Kind of makes it sound a bit American. But ultimately, if you want the record company to keep. You know, to keep going and keep making records, you do need to shift a lot. And the lovely thing about an album is that, you know, you can have a hit single, but really you're only talking about two tracks there, the A side and the B side. Which, in another interesting thing too, is that people don't realise that the B side sells exactly as many copies as the A side. So we used to do a thing in the beginning when sort of money was tight. Say Mike had written the A side, Flying on the Wings of Love, for example. On the B side, we do an instrumental version because we didn't have any other songs, but we did an instrumental version. And we used to say, because people were soloing and stuff, we used to give everybody a songwriter credit, even though really it was Mike's tune. But that way, everybody got a slice of the cake. And it was something that we did for sort of lots of singles on there. If you sort of look, if it's the same single on the A side as the B side, then you'll see there's more credits on the B side. And it was just a way of sort of, you know, spreading the love, I suppose, around the band and making everybody feel that they were involved. But with an album, of course, you've got 10, 12 songs. And you're always tied to the fact, because it was still vinyl was ruling the day then, you were still tied to the, you know, you had a maximum of 24 minutes aside. Otherwise, you had to go to a smaller groove, which you could get more time on. But then the quality of the record was so bad and so quiet, and they used to jump very quickly. So that was about the max you could get, 24 aside.
I was just thinking about vinyl. When I was a kid, buying records, I think it was about 32 shillings of, you know, but now they've come back, they're very expensive, aren't they?
Well, vinyl's not too bad. You know, it's the thing is, it's still a niche market. I suppose compared to downloads or CDs it is, which are about $4.99 now. But there's, once again, there's been this other turnaround, John, you know, that in 1987-88, when we were playing, you know, we were playing Wembley Arenas and similar sort of venues, ticket prices were really, really low. You know, you could go and see the band, £6, and it, you know, nowadays that seems incredible when you're talking 37, 50, you know, 50 quid a ticket. But the album was £17.99, you know, £18.50 or something. So we were lucky because we were shifting loads of that. And that was where the money was making. Now, of course, it's turned around, and I'm glad that I'm still out and touring, because there it is.
I think I saw the Rolling Stones at Ryan Pavilion for something like 3 and 6, I think.
And I bet that seemed like quite a lot of money at the time.
Yeah. You played in many, many countries. Do audiences differ that much, Mark?
Well, not really, no. The you know, music's the unifying thing here, and, you know, the audiences come... You know, they come because they know who you are and they know what they're going to get. So consequently, you know, they love hearing the songs that they know. And the response that you get from them is the same anyway. It doesn't matter if you're playing in Chile or you're playing in Norway, you know, or Japan or Canada, you know, or the UK. It's the same thing. People love music, and that's one of the real strengths. Is it's a real unifying thing, you know, and it is powerful. I know that there are sort of people would scoff and say, well, there's no real power in music. There really, really is, because it is it's a universal language that crosses all the barriers. And you know, that I would have thought that pop and rock and roll have been more responsible for the spread of the English language than probably anything else.
I want to take you back to a night which must have been a dream for you. You were in a finale supergroup, right? Paul McCartney, Elton John, Eric Clapton, Mark Knopfler, Phil Collins, Tina Turner, Paul Young, George Michael, David Bowie, Mick Jagger, Mark King. Not bad, was it?
Why'd you put me in there? That's awful, John. I should have been mid-table. No, it was really quite something. I kid you.
McCartney was a real fan of yours, wasn't he?
Well, he was such a sweetheart. I'd never met the guy before. And obviously, he was... And still is the biggest name in music. I mean, everybody knows, the great Paul McCartney, Sir Paul McCartney. We were having sound check and I was sort of noodling with my amplifier on stage in a quiet moment. And this just voice said, "Mark King, what a lovely to meet you." That's not a very good impression, is it? I should get my mate Sean to do it. And it was Paul McCartney. And that is quite a grounding moment because you turn around and you think, oh, my Lord. Anyway, I said, not now, Paul. I'm busy, as you can see.
And Reg Dwight, otherwise. Oh, yeah. He liked you, didn't he?
Well, that was really one of the sweet things is that they, Eric would walk on stage and Elton would say, "Morning, Eric." And Eric would say, "Morning, Reg." And it was like being on a building site somewhere. Great stuff.
You and Mike Lindup have sort of been the constant forces within Level 42, haven't you?
Well, we're the remaining guys from the original lineup. Boone and Phil both left in 1987, and that which was quite seismic. We were kind of at the peak of our powers, and they decided they'd had enough and wanted out, and that's fair enough. I mean, their decision, their choice, and off they go. And I think we had to do the Tina Turner tour with Paul Gendler on guitar. And the drummer from Prefab Sprout, Neil Conti. And they were fantastic guys. They came in, jumped in, learnt the whole set, 10 days. But for me, the tension of thinking, oh my goodness, this is, I need to sort something out here. And I said to Mike, look, I'm going to keep going with this. Are you sort of up for it? And Mike was, he said, I'm with you, Mark. And that was it. And we sort of soldiered on until we got to 94. And then it seemed that Britpop had moved in and, there was sort of a negativity in the press about old dinosaurs like us sticking around. But that was fine because, that is as music should be. Mm. There should always be the next wave coming in. And it wasn't as if we hadn't had a good bite of the cherry till that point. So I was quite happy just to take a break and a rest and come back to the lovely Isle of Wight and, spend some time with the kids and...
You had a few solo projects. You had an album in 98, One Man, which I still play. I love it.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, well, that actually followed. I had my first solo record was in 1984 called Influences.
That's and, it. I've got that on vinyl, I think.
Have you really?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Yeah. Well, don't lose it.
No.
It's rare. I still get I still get statements from Polydor saying how much I still owe them for the making of that record because it was, it wasn't sort of massively successful, but I'm very proud of it. And it's, to me, it was sort of a good statement of intent about, okay, us is the band that play, The Sun Goes Down, Limit It Up and Love Games and stuff. But actually there's this side to what I like and people who have influenced me. And this is where I did. And I was so thrilled that in 2012 I got the chance to play most of it live at Ronnie Scott's. I did a week there in London, which is how I got to meet the brass players that travel with us now, that tour now with us. So
you retired, or the group did for a while, and then you suddenly decided to get back together. Did you play at a wedding? Is that a fact or not?
It was Mike Lindup's wedding. Mike invited us all along. Which of course, was brilliant. He's a sort of a best mate. But that didn't have anything to do with the band getting back together, John. When I made the One Man album, I started doing some gigs with that album and I sort of put together a band. My brother Nathan, this first time he came in and worked with me on guitar and vocals. And we had Trevor Smith, another good Isle of Wight boy, came and did the tour with us on drums. And Lyndon Connor, a friend, did keyboard. So we were sort of touring around Europe. And got to the end of that tour and it went very well. We were only playing small venues and clubs and things, sort of really going back to square one. But Neil Warnock, my agent, sweetheart, said, "Mark, we a lot of demand here for shows. There's more. Do you want to do?" And he said, "Could you get a few more Level 42 songs in the set, though? Because the audiences are going to want it." So I did. And I'd co-written the songs as well. So I had no problem playing Lessons in Love and Something About You and Leaving Me Now, et cetera, Running in the Family. And that's really how something just occurred to me that, look, I'm playing, really a Level 42 set. It would be lovely if Mike you know, would come in and do it. And he did. And that's it. And then we were sort of back in the saddle and off we go.
He's a great guy because you arranged a few years ago for me to go to his house and do an interview with him. And
That's me. I'm all yes. Hard, John.
But he had a sound of his own with his vocals, very high pitched.
Certainly. Yeah, well, Mike's got a great voice. His, you know, his normal range is just brilliant as well. Now, Mike's a real talent. And his dad, you know, it was a really, really famous arranger for not just the BBC, but in the film world as well. That was David Lindup. And he did a lot of work with a lot of famous people, and obviously saw the talent in his young son Mike, and put him at Chetham's music school in Manchester. So Mike really is sort of, he knows all the stuff that I don't know.
And you made an album called Retroglide, didn't you, with the new band, if you like.
Yeah. It's 2006, and we had the great Gary Husband came in and played drums with us again on that. Another phenomenal musician, and you know, one of the great sort of jazz musicians in British music today, and sort of so respected. And I was so lucky that I got the chance to play with Gary all those years in Level 42, and we become the very best of friends, you know, that I could only sort of dream to have the talent that guy has got.
Mark, you don't really have to do this. You do it because you love the music, don't you, really?
Yeah, I do, John. I absolutely love playing. I love performing too. You know, it's such a buzz going on stage. And I even like the nerves before it, you know, that sort of that trepidation. I'm getting them now, you know, that we're just off rehearsal start in 2 days' time. So there's a frantic programming me in the studio at the moment and dragging out all kinds of old instruments that I haven't played in ages, and I'm getting the pre-tour nightmares where, you know, the curtain goes up and there's no one in the audience and my guitar's unplugged and the strings break and all of that sort of thing, and you wake up sweating. But I don't mind that, you know, because 2 gigs in and it'll be good as gold.
Just take me back to the amazing gig you did on the Isle of Wight at the Ryde Arena
when it
was a full house, and I'll never forget, all we could see was the lights on your bass guitar.
Oh, is that all you could see? No, well, that's all right.
And then the lights came on.
It's better than looking in my face.
But that was a rather special night, wasn't it?
It was a lovely night. You know, the Ryde Arena had opened, and it seemed the perfect opportunity to be able to say, look, you know, we can play to 2,200 people here. And the tickets sold out in no time at all, which was brilliant. And so it was great to do that. And I'm so sorry that it's fallen into disrepair and, you know, it's been sort of sold off by the various ice rink companies that have had it, because the venue, you know, it wasn't perfect, but it certainly wasn't bad. And it's as, you know, same with Ryde Theatre. I'm so sad that shut, you know, it was a lovely place, but, you know, austerity, money, you know, the council can't keep paying this stuff and all of these things. These are the things that we lose.
Any plans to record anymore? Any new songs or?
Well, yeah, there are. You know, it's the problem for me, John, is, and it's not a problem. It's just that the reality is, you know, if I go out, you know, we've got, I don't know, 12 studio albums or something, and there's so many songs to choose from, and so many songs that have been hits that the audience that are going to come along will want to hear that. And I'm not about to stand on stage for 3 hours, you know, because I think that's just too much. It's ridiculous. So, in other words, to get all the hits in and the songs that people really do want to hear means that you're not going to stand there and say, we're going to play our new album in its entirety. I've done it before, and the look of horror on the audience faces is quite palpable. So, you know, why do that? You know, if I'm inspired and I've got something that I think is really great, then I'll do a bit like I did with the Sirens thing, really. I'll sort of get it out under the radar, and, you know, the new fans can sort of pick it up, the hardcore fans. It's a bit like, it sort of brings me to this this compilation CD that you brought along with us that Universal have put out, I guess, quite recently, and it's yet another compilation. And I have no problem with this at all, and the reason I have no problem with it is that, and a lot of fans do, because they go, why are they just re-releasing the old stuff again, you know? And the reason is because, well, the compilation that you bought 10 years ago, maybe, has been deleted. Mm. They don't make that anymore. And then they did another compilation 5 years later, you know, which you probably didn't buy because you had the other one, and that's deleted now. So any new youngsters coming along, looking at social media, catching your band on YouTube and thinking, oh, wow, I'd love to buy the material.
There's 5 albums on there.
Yeah, exactly. It's 5 albums in this pack. And if that's it, if you want it, there it is. And that's why I love it, because for the new fans, they can still buy the music.
What's the greatest moment in your career so far?
Was it apart from talking to you here right now, John?
Yeah.
It's very hard. No, I couldn't pick one, John. I really couldn't. I mean, I can't touch this wood table enough to appreciate the good fortune I've had, you know, because as you pointed out earlier on, you know, I'm certainly not academic. So if I hadn't made it here, I don't know what I'd be doing. Probably still doing the milk round.
Any less favourite moments or not really, or you sort of taken
no, you've got to take the good with the bad, you know, that the you know, obviously losing Al Murphy in 1989 was horrible, and particularly after we'd sort of, you know, the band had got back and we were sort of, by 1988 we just cut the Staring at the Sun album, and I was really pleased with that, and I thought, here we go, we've got a new direction, we're going to be off and running. So to have that, you know, your hopes built up, and then, you know, and then to be sort of so cruelly dashed with Al's tragic passing. You know, that's obviously a horrible memory. But, you know, you tell me anywhere in life where it's just a constant upward climb of bliss and everything's brilliant, you know, and I'll show you someone who's deluded.
You're a true Islander too, because you went away for a while, but you came back.
It pulls you back just when you think you've escaped. Well, you know, I've got family here, and family, you know, family's everything, really. You know, what are you without your family? And my family have always been lovely. So, you know, my mum's still alive, thank goodness. So, you know, why would I not want to be able to just sort of pop up and see her for a cup of tea and a slice of cake every so often? And I can't do that if I'm living in London.
Any dreams left for Mark King?
Well, apart from the nightmarish ones about nobody in the audience when I go on stage.
Oh, that will never happen.
Any dreams left? Well, no, just, you know, long may this continue, John. I mean, I really won't. It's when people stop coming to see the shows, I'll stop going out and doing it, because I wouldn't want to embarrass anyone, you know. But no, they're not, you know. We're going well. The tickets have been selling amazingly well. So I'm going to keep doing it, John.
I'm going to give the gigs out in a few minutes where you're actually playing during October.
Yeah, thank you.
You've done a lot for the Isle of Wight because you encourage young people, and it's always nice when somebody who's famous, world famous, puts something back into their local community. So I'm very grateful for that.
Well, that's very kind of you, John. Thank you very much. I think anybody's duty bound, really, aren't they, to, you know, to help out where you can. And I do like to do that. You know, I have a charity on the island that I'm very proud to be patron of, which is Beaulieu Respite Centre in Fairlie at Newport on the Isle of Wight. They do such an amazing job for, you know, physically and mentally handicapped kids. And I'm also a big supporter of Nordoff Robbins Music Therapy Charity, which is a charity that's supported really by our business. It's like the media do it. So it's all the publishers and the record companies and this, that and the other, and the sports world. And I love being involved in that too. And the Isle of Wight Youth Trust is another fantastic charity that I'm always happy to support if I can.
Mark, during my life, I've been so thrilled by the success of local Isle of Wight people. And I've always admired what you've achieved. It's an amazing career. And when I think back to 1980, I don't think either of us could have imagined what you were going to do in those.
No, probably not, you know, but it's a good job, isn't it? You know, that careful what you wish for and all that.
When you were playing somewhere like Warner's Puckpool or Sinclair in a band, did you ever have a dream then or not really?
Yeah, this is all I've ever wanted to do. I mean, this is it. So that old phrase of living the dream is, you're looking at it.
Mark, it's always a real pleasure to meet you, and I wish your career continued success.
Thank you, John. It's lovely talking to you again, mate, you know.
And I love your sense of humour, because a few years ago I ran by your house, which is rather remote. You were gardening and you gave me a bit of friendly stick, I think. I've never forgotten.
Oh, did I? Yeah. Well, put those knees up, Hannum.
Something like that, yeah. Good luck.
Thank you.
It's great. He's got a swell personality. He meets and greets the stars with such amenity. Good enough to make you coming out of the street. John Hannamy. That's right.
Thanks to Mark King. He's always great fun.
I promised some Level 42 dates. Here they are for October 2018. The 2nd Glasgow Royal Concert Hall, the 3rd Manchester Opera House, the 4th Leicester de Montfort Hall, the 6th Southend Cliffs Pavilion, the 7th Oxford New Theatre, the 8th the Reading Hexagon, the 9th Guildford G Live, the 11th Portsmouth Guildhall, the 12th Ipswich Regent Theatre, the 13th Northampton Royal and Durngate, the 15th York Barbican, the 16th Gateshead the Sage, the 17th Birmingham Symphony Hall, the 19th Liverpool Philharmonic Hall, the 20th Cardiff St David's Hall, the 21st Bristol Hippodrome, the 23rd Bournemouth Pavilion, the 24th Brighton Dome, and the 25th London's Royal Albert Hall.
Hi, Chill Blazers. Nick Frisby here saying John Hannam is a puppet.
You've been listening to John Hannam Eats, courtesy of Isle of Wight Radio. Don't forget to look at my website, johnhannam.com, for news of more interviews and how you might purchase my books. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye for now.